Hi, I'm Jack from Socrates, and I'm at the radio station with my sister Katie. You're listening to WGXC Aqua. Have a nice day!
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. And we've got a busy show today. We're going to hear from Lindsay Strelow from Cornell Cooperative Extension, previewing events there, talking about climate resilience, too. And we'll hear about an important local meeting in Housatonic tonight about drinking water. Plus, Philip Grant has the local news. Catskill Maker Syndicate bring you the better weather. And we'll hear national headlines from the Public News Service on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
This is the network, network. On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network, network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network.
Wave Farms Public Art Park begins opening Saturdays on June 3rd for drop-in visits anytime between noon and 6 p.m. The art park is on Wave Farms' 29-acre campus in Accra, featuring 13 installations. The study center, including a research library, the WGXC 90.7 FM Accra broadcast studio, and accommodations for Wave Farms' International Artist Residency Program. Visitors to Wave Farms Art Park receive a guided tour of the campus. Admission is free, and tours typically last between 60 and 90 minutes. The art park is available to see on other days through October through reservations at wavefarm.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years. Offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Edward Ruschalski of Syracuse, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Tuesday, September 26th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Jamal Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that the Hudson School Board seems reluctant to help the city of Hudson create new affordable housing. The Hudson Valley and the entire state are in an affordable housing crisis. Hudson officials hope to build a 60-unit apartment complex on vacant land on Mill Street across from Charles Williams Park. In 1983, the school board gave the land to the city, but included a restriction that the property be used for, quote, park and recreational purposes only, unquote, and that any other use would revert ownership of the property to the school district. Now school officials seem reluctant to void that restriction to allow for affordable housing. A statement from the board released September 25th said, quote, the Board of Education simply cannot okay a city request, and the board and or city cannot simply withdraw or ignore the park and recreational purposes clause. That restriction in the 1983 deed must be legally addressed before a housing plan can move forward, unquote. The board said in its statement that it does not consider affordable housing a, quote, public benefit, unquote. Mayor Kamal Johnson's office then released its own statement, challenging the board's statement that the city has not provided its plan, saying they have been trying to talk with school officials for months. Quote, this particular sale is for the purpose of developing affordable housing, which existing case law successfully argues can be considered a public benefit, unquote, the mayor's office said. Quote, the housing project at Mill Street plans to have rental prices set at affordable rates ranging from 30% to 110% of the area median income, unquote. The school district also implied that new housing would mean new students that the school could not handle. Johnson's statement addressed this issue, saying, quote, Hudson City School District enrollment has decreased over 10% between 2017 and 2021 and 33% since 1997. This pattern of decreased enrollment is increasingly common in rural parts of the Hudson Valley due to the trend of fewer births and out-migration due to the rising cost of living. The district lost funding in recent years because local demographics have changed. The city of Hudson hopes to prevent further drops in enrollment by providing housing for families, unquote. At the September 12th Board of Education meeting, Johnson said, quote, I don't have to remind the school district about the city's problems with housing at the moment. Housing is an immediate need. It's the reason we can't find any teachers, especially those of color, and the reason we can't fill positions in all our services, including our hospitals, unquote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Michael Ryan at the Mountain Eagle reports that the Windham Town Board last week accepted the retirement of Windham Police Chief Tor Tryland, effective October 15th. The story says that, quote, Tryland has been on an extended leave of absence since this past spring, reportedly attending to family matters in his native country, unquote. David Sherman Jr. has been taking care of local administrative duties while Tryland was gone, and also working as a sergeant with the Catskill Police Department. Town Supervisor Thomas Hoyt said, quote, I'm pulling my hair out, trying to do what's best for our community, unquote, searching for a replacement for Tryland. Quote, staffing has become an issue over the past few years for the Windham Police Department, unquote, he said. Hoyt also said, quote, we can't offer as much as other agencies do. It's a simple fact. We have started initial conversations with members of our police force, the union, and the sheriff's department about how we as a community can overcome this obstacle, unquote. Read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that Representative Mark Molinaro has moved to Catskill. Now the congressional representative lives in the district he represents. Until now, Molinaro has been living in the 18th congressional district while representing the 19th district. Molinaro did not provide a comment about the move, which was announced by his spokesperson, Dan Kantz. Molinaro won his office while living out of the district in 2022, but promised to move into the district. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman, and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, September 26th. Local early morning temperatures range from 41 degrees in Medusa to 55 in Red Hook. Regional average soil temperature is 64 degrees. Thanks to continuing fires in western Canada, smoke levels have risen again. The Twin Counties are going to have around 1 to 2 micrograms per cubic meter. Areas to the north, like Albany, will likely have it a bit thicker. Skies are going to be dreary anyway, with only a bit of sun poking through. We get a high temperature of 65 at 3 p.m. Overnight, skies clear out a bit and we get a low of 43. Tomorrow, partly cloudy skies, cool morning, comfortable afternoon, and a high of 69 at 3 p.m. 45 degrees overnight takes us into another nice-looking Thursday with a high of 69. Friday cools off a bit with a chance for light rain. However, the weekend is looking pretty decent. Stay tuned. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 12:24 a.m., low tide at 7:24 a.m., high tide again at 1:05 p.m., then low tide once again at 7:36 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 66 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 6:34 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:43 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 15%. Plasma winds will be average at 473 kilometers per second, with an average density of 5 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently terrible, with some bands verging on closed till dark, then maybe okay conditions below 4 MHz overnight. There are low chances of aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 164, and this has been the better weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
The international struggles of our world may lead to
nuclear holocaust.
To survive, you must have protection from radioactive fallout.
In the past, heavy equipment necessitated a long, costly operation for out-of-home shelter installation.
Today, Survive All basement-type shelters offer a combination steel and concrete do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved, Survive All offers maximum protection from fallout and falling debris. Plus, a basic equipment kit for family survival.
There's low initial cost and FHA approval. Nothing down in 5 years to pay.
For your family's protection, see a Survive All shelter today.
So we are now, we're going right back to Housatonic, South Berkshire County, right here in the middle of Hoosie, where, as some of you listeners have been listening, know quite well, because I've been mentioning it, Tom mentioned it too, we have serious water woes with our town water. It's a very complicated situation, and we are one of only five municipalities, and we can go into this deeper, in the entire state of Massachusetts that is a privatized, privately owned water company for profit. And therein lies the rub and the conflict of interest, because we have been suffering for decades and decades of brown water. Now we're talking water tainted with carcinogens, things like heliocetic acid, and all sorts of just gobbledygook in this mess of a water system. And it doesn't seem to be entering into a phase of resolution and figuring out a solution, and both sides are kind of digging in. And so I have here right with me, live next to me right now, a wonderful person named Ani, who is going to talk to you a little bit about what's going on with the water and what people are doing about it. This is a very small community, a former factory town, in which people haven't always been that empowered to do anything against the man. I just, unfortunately, there hasn't been a big push against this private company that serves our water. And Ani, welcome to the Monday afternoon show, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you. This is a treat. I'm glad to be here. Yeah. So. Yeah, my name is Ani. I don't have any titles. I'm just a citizen of Housatonic, and I've been living with this water for several decades. And I got involved because actually I personally don't have brown water in my house, because some of these are old iron pipes. A lot of New England has pipes that are really outdated, and it's not just Housatonic. And so it's a pretty big problem. But when you have a privatized water company, I hate to say it, but it's kind of up to them how much they invest in their infrastructure. The Department of Environmental Protection and the Department of Public Utilities are supposed to be the watchdogs. They have set certain standards, but we have found that they have been pretty useless in really coming forward and actually forcing certain issues with the company. The town has been trying its best, would love to take over the company. Well, I don't actually think they would love to, because it's not in good financial situation. And as I said, the infrastructure, the cleaning system, the filtration system is so outdated. So the town would rather have nothing to do with it, because it's really a money sink. However, the town does recognize that this is unsustainable, that there is a father-son owners that have six-figure salaries. I'm not saying they're raking it in hugely, but they have six-figure salaries and have not significantly improved the system, so that we do have these manganese and the haloacetic acids. And so they're proposing this green sands filtration system that they've been piloting, and it is a bit experimental. And now they want to give us 113% rate hike.
Yes.
Yeah. And we're paying $41 base price per household right now, and that is higher than the average in Massachusetts. And they want to increase it by 113% for water that is essentially poisonous and brown. And so tomorrow night, the Department of Public Utilities is having a hearing about this rate hike at Monument Mountain Regional High School at 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock. It's an open hearing. Anybody can come. Please, you know, the more we have, more people we have, I think the more our voices will be heard. And we're having a protest beforehand. We're gathering at 5:30 at the high school, and we start our protest at 5:45 to 6:45 to show the Select Board of Great Barrington and the DPU and possibly a representative from the Attorney General's office. I don't know if Smitty Pignatelli will be there, but you know, anybody who's driving in will see us, and we need people to come in numbers. So this is a shout out to everybody and anybody who would like to support this hamlet of Great Barrington in opposing the corrupt practices of this privatized company. It's just abominable. And citizens have tried to take him to court, small claims court. Every time he brings out his big lawyers and squashes the cases. We have hired a lawyer out of a firm in Boston. That happened last year, and we got an excellent demand letter. We could have gone to court, but we just didn't have the money. It's just simple. It's not a rich town. It's a very middle-class town, working people. A lot of people don't have extra time. And that kind of court case, even with a good environmental law firm like that, costs money. So that's the situation.
Here we go, Ani. And so you're kind of going around the community right now, rallying people, getting them to participate in whatever little bits of democracy that were afforded, such as showing up at the town meeting. Now, over there in New York, in Greene and Columbia County, they don't have town meeting. It's interesting. They have a very different structure of government, the city council over there, which is different than Massachusetts. And that's the difference between the Dutch and the English going way back hundreds of years. But we won't get into that. But privatized water, like, this is a perfect example as to why there are certain things in life, certain areas of culture, of basic human needs and living, where I feel like the profit motive and the privatization reality is just a conflict of interest. And I think water might be one of those areas.
Absolutely. Water, all of our natural resources, well, of course, not all of them, but certainly water should be a public right. And the watchdogs that are supposed to keep it regulated, because we have so many carcinogens around us and pollutants, are kind of just big bureaucratic monsters that don't have enough manpower to really do it properly. So they kick the can, and then the town doesn't want to take it on for the reasons I mentioned. So
right, but if you don't mind me interrupting, like, I did hear, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but like Great Barrington reluctantly, I think, realizes that they will eventually have to take Housatonic is like a sub hamlet, a village of Great Barrington.
Yes.
And it was a factory town. The factory towns, you know, they built the factories and in some cases built the entire infrastructure of the town, sewer, yes, water, and housing for workers, roads for their mega profits, you know, in the 1800s when these factories were raking it in, for the owners wanted to have the infrastructure to keep the profits rolling in, including the water systems. Great Barrington will have to take this water system over. I think they had conversations with the owner, who should probably remain nameless, Jim Mercer. Sorry. And they didn't want to sell. They refused to sell the company to Great Barrington because, in my opinion, what I think is going on is they want to eke out the last couple years of profits that they might be able to milk out of this failing, corroding, and falling apart infrastructure of the water system. And then call it quits when it's really crashed and burned, and be like, here you go, Great Barrington. Here, have a $10 million problem to have to solve to redo all the pipes.
I don't think that's...
You think I'm far off?
I don't think you're far off. It's still bewildering to me why anybody would want to be so despised, first of all, by...
Yeah, it's like a little Napoleonic complex of you digging in.
And then why they'd want to hold on to this problematic beast. You know, why they wouldn't just want to move it out. And sell it for less, because neither of them are short on cash.
Listen, if they sell it for $3 million right now to the town of Great Barrington, they're going to retire. You don't have to go around fixing angry people's, and try to charge them for their water mains from whatever. Now it's your fault. We have to charge you $10,000 to fix your water main, because even though that wasn't originally planned, because it's a factory town and we built all the water mains, well, we're going to make you pay for it. And if you don't want to pay your bill because you're mad, some people might not have been paying their bill, we're going to put a lien on your house.
Yes.
And we want to come in your house unannounced, or we want to look at your meters. And just this whole it's like an emotional content to this weird thing going on, isn't there?
It is very, and it's interesting because I'm walking around house to house, and every door I knock on, they're like, oh God, you see this look of dread on their face. Yeah. Like, oh God, yeah, that.
Oh yeah, the
and
water.
A lot of people have invested in huge filtration systems or they've dug their own well, but that's not possible for everybody.
I can't dig one here. Haliocytic acid, you do not have to boil your water. This is not an emergency. And then with a subclause, in the state of California, it's known to cause cancer. It's like, well, how come California knows about it? how come California knows about all these things and we don't? Haliocytic acid is not something you want to be ingesting regularly, and you can't boil it out. And here's the weird thing, is that our water here in Housatonic comes from one of the most beautiful, pristine, cleanest water sources that we have. It's Long Pond, right up the road here.
Yeah.
And from what I've understood is Long Pond has this beautiful, healthy, clean water. They take it out of the pond, the reservoir, whatever it is, and proceed to just mess it all up with their little recipes and their chlorines and their fluorides and then all their corroded cast iron, galvanized iron pipes that they installed in the 1980s because they wanted to cut corner on costs and not do it the right way. So now it's rusting, whatever it is.
All of that is true.
Okay.
I think that a lot of these pipes were, in the 30s put in. 40s.
Okay.
They weren't because of this company. The problem is the company hasn't been gradually changing them over, modernizing them at the rate they should have, reinvesting profits into that.
Interesting.
The other thing is, yes, I think it's a clean water source, but I think that their intake on it is not deep. This part I need to verify, but when you with climate change, end of the summer, you get a lot more algae, it's hot. And then if your intake is too close to the surface, you get more bacteria.
Okay.
And then with climate change, there is more bacteria, which requires more chlorine. Now, if you had a up-to-date filtration system, they could really regulate that. It's high tech. And this filtration system is not. It's old, and they've been, I've heard that they just sort of do it by instinct. They throw in the chlorine by instinct. It's not a very...
You get these letters here in Hoosie. We get these letters where all of a sudden, things are way real bad this month. We kind of messed up the recipe. And it's like, what are they doing? Who's regulating this stuff? What engineers do they have on what is the recipe for delivering?
Should be. That's where we disappointed.
So the system's pretty broken there.
We're really disappointed with our agencies. And that's why we need people tomorrow night to really... let the DPU know that they already granted a rate hike to Housatonic Water Works. When was it? It was 96 or something. And it was 35%, and promises were made that weren't kept. So they should not be permitted to have a rate hike, which I think is a good way to give the town more leverage to buy the company. If they can't get a rate hike, there's a chance that...
Why doesn't he just throw in the towel? It's unbelievable. Just sell the company, call it quits. All 800 households here will stop hating you as much. It's unbelievable. The first thing I learned when I moved to Housatonic is people really don't like Jim Mercer and Housatonic Water Works. And it's a major problem. And it's because they dig in. It becomes this confrontational.
Yes.
There's no healthy conversation. There's no solution based. There's no resolution based conversation to move forward towards a goal. It's I'm going to dig in my side. Nothing's wrong with your water. And just give me your money. And I'm going to give myself a pay raise and a pay hike. And I got my whole family to support. And it's really hard being the owner of a company. And we're here we have little children that you're telling us to bathe in brown water. My newborn baby is supposed to bathe in your brown water, and you're sending me letters that saying, "What's your problem? There's nothing wrong with it. It's just a little brown."
Well, they're like, saying that so according childish. To the DEP, manganese, which is what makes it brown, is not a health hazard, which is possibly true.
Right.
But when, you know, so he's hiding under that.
Right. But the manganese. It's just a little manganese.
Live with brown water coming out, and it ruins your clothes. You can't cook with it. You know, you can't bathe in it. It's just horrible. And then with the haloacetic acid, it is they're saying, oh, well, temporarily it's okay because it is short term. You can ingest a certain amount, but it's over decades. It causes something similar to Parkinson's.
So by the time we sell it to Great Barrington, you guys will be fine, we think, probably. So, yeah. Okay. Well, we have work to do. Ani, I appreciate you coming to talk about our water and the fact that especially the ones with small children in their households and people, this was an old factory town, working class town. The factories all closed down and left. So now it's just like people do whatever they have to do in this small little sleepy village.
It's a great town.
It's a great place to be. And not everyone has the means. Luckily I do, where my cows are located over on West Plain Road, where there's a deep, deep well that's very healthy. The water has just been awesome. And I go bring water to my cows, and I get water for my house. Well, not everyone in Housatonic has the means to go buy water, to lug water into the house, to, like, bathe in it. You know, it's a lot of work.
And never has he offered – I mean, there's been so many requests for compensation for the cost of water.
Just throw me a bone here.
Nothing. Yeah. And no, he's always just, on the defensive.
That's what makes it really yucky, is when you have the owners of the company, like, really not – doing anything in the PR realm. They're just like, it's like it feels like a middle finger.
It is
from
it
them does feel every like time. It. Like, absolutely. Are you serious? Like, I came in with a neutral, objective, you know, attitude towards this when we first moved here, and it became like, okay, so you guys are really not our friend.
No, and I mean, I had some great conversations with him when he talks really good talk. When I first move in here, I'm really not the kind of person who sees the worst in somebody. I just treated him like a responsible business owner, you know. Yeah. And then it's over the years, this cumulative disregard for the people of this town. It's just appalling.
Anyway. It is. Well, Ani, you're encouraging people to come to the meeting tomorrow night at Monument Mountain High School. The protest will be happening beforehand at 5:30. The meeting's at 6:00.
Seven.
Okay.
Protest 5:45 to 6:45. And then we can all file into the meeting and witness how this goes, or you can go home or
Democracy
whatever.
Democracy in action. Yes. Well, there may be some strong words tomorrow night.
Yeah, maybe.
I should probably keep quiet.
No, I don't think so.
I'll bring my Zoom recording device. Tom Rowe over at Wave Farm, get ready. We may have some controversial audio to run by you from Monument Mountain High School tomorrow. So, you know, we're doing this for the community. It's just a matter of simple, you know, community rights. Clean water, it really is a human right. Like, when you're in a developed, so-called wealthiest nation on earth,
you'd think we'd have things like this
figured out a little better, honey.
I know. Can I make a very quick, more fun announcement?
Please do. Okay. Yeah, because I got a little work to do.
Me too. Also in Housatonic, on Wednesday night, there's this beautiful little art center called the Center for Peace Through Culture.
Oh, yeah. It's right next to these people.
Oh, it is so
This
great.
Is the next one over, I think.
Yes, that's it.
Oh, no, it is them. Yeah. So I stopped by, I was walking the dog, and this wonderful young woman came out and handed me the flyer.
Yes. There's art exhibits, and there's poetry slams, and there's open mic nights, and I'm doing a shout out for the Center for Peace Through Culture, so look it up. But also, I love to dance. I just love to boogie. So I started a once a month, 7 to 9 p.m. It's called Let's Dance. It's super simple, great music. You come, you dance, you go home and go to bed.
Well, and this is at the Arts for Center for Peace Through Culture on Front Street in Housie.
Yep.
And it's when is
the last Wednesday of every month, so it's day after tomorrow. And it's like $5 to $10 just to support the Center for Peace Through Culture. And you just, if you love to dance and you don't feel like there's enough opportunities just to get out and boogie.
There aren't enough opportunities to get out and boogie.
Yeah.
I'm speaking from experience.
Need, especially going into the winter. We need to have some fun.
We got a boogie. Got a boogie on it. Well, this is great. Great yes. initiative. Thank you for doing that. Thanks for coming spontaneously kind of on the radio here. Ani from Hoosie. Talk about the Hoosie Waterworks. Talk about the meeting tomorrow night. We're going to raise some holy hell and hopefully get some solutions and resolutions to this water issue we have.
Great. So, thank you.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
For 30 years, I have withdrawn thousands of dollars in cash from my personal savings account, which I have kept for emergencies and because of the history of my family facing confiscation in Cuba.
New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez is trying to explain the $500,000 in cash federal investigators found at his home. Menendez is maintaining his innocence to the bribery, fraud, and extortion charges he's been indicted on and says he won't resign despite calls to do so. Previous corruption charges against him ended in a 2015 mistrial. With 4 days left to avoid a shutdown, nonpartisan and nonprofit groups are pushing Congress to keep the government open. Make the Road Action in New York is pressing Republican Representative Anthony D'Esposito to stand up to hard-right Republicans holding up passage of funding bills. Angel Reyes Rivas is with the group.
A solution would be for the people, being Democrat or being Republican, that really care about these communities and understand the importance of these benefits to pass something, right? Because a government shutdown, it's unacceptable.
In a shutdown, Social Security checks still go out, though some SNAP benefits might not, and some Medicare services could be delayed. According to the New York Times, a bipartisan group of senators is working on a plan to keep the government funded. The upper house does not normally originate budget bills, but the Times reports senators are now discussing a funding measure with the White House and considering whether to include more aid for Ukraine. A federal judge is blocking a 2022 Arizona law requiring registered voters to provide proof of a physical address. Supporters say it would aid election integrity and stop illegal voting, but Allison Nesswood with the Native American Rights Fund says there are more than 40,000 homes on reservations without a physical address, and the people who live there could lose their voice.
Wanting to make sure that a new law that's sort of targeting the specific structural issues that Native Americans face was really important, I think, for the tribes who participated in the case and who brought the issue forward and wanted to make sure that these addressing issues didn't get lost.
With a deal in the writer's strike looking likely, attention in Hollywood is turning to the actor's strike. When they return to bargaining, it'll be 2 months since the studios met with the actors' union. For Hispanic Heritage Month, Battleborn Progress in Nevada is reaching out to the Latino third of the state's people to make them more politically engaged. Maite Guerra with the group says given this population's hunger for information, the group is developing an accessible information hub for Spanish speakers in the Silver State.
Something else that we're doing is fact-checking a lot of right-wing politicians. So just making sure that what is being said in the political sphere is accurate and not targeting our community.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Eligible citizens in Pennsylvania will now be automatically registered to vote when obtaining a new driver's license or state ID unless they opt out of the system. Such automatic voter registration or ADR systems have registered millions of voters in the 23 states where it's been implemented. Pennsylvania has been offering opt-in voter registration at the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, known as PennDOT, where eligible voters could answer questions and have their registration submitted to local officials by the agency. The change ordered by Governor Josh Shapiro on National Voter Registration Day allows PennDOT to use verified residency and citizenship documents used in their process to automatically register the citizen to vote. VoteBeat reports that PennDOT's voter registration efforts have not always been smooth and that some state officials were surprised by Shapiro's announcement. In the year after Colorado implemented automatic voter registration in 2020, 250,000 new voters were registered, including thousands of young voters. In a 10-month period in 2022, Colorado averaged over 14,000 new AVR registrations per month. In an interview on MSNBC, Governor Shapiro said there are an estimated 1.6 million Pennsylvanians who qualify as voters but who are not registered. We have links to articles about Pennsylvania's new system and a study about Colorado's AVR success at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal. Find us on Facebook at American Democracy Minute.
I just got a message. Devin Connolly, we got Devin from Cornell Cooperative Extension. Usually we do once a month together. We have Lindsay Strelow pinch hitting for Audrey, and she's here to just take the bat and swing. Or Lindsay, I would love to just go launch right on into it, and off the cuff, here we go. What do you think?
Sure, I'll do my best.
Sure. Well, you're there. You got headphones on and a microphone. You're at Wave Farm, and so already you're winning.
That's a plus.
Okay. So, all right. So we got right now on Zoom, and please help me to say your last name, Lindsay Strelow.
Close. So Strelow, like stray dog and Law and Order.
Like Law and Order. I like the analogy. My brother used to watch that show, and it's just, yeah, that's how I'll remember now. Lindsay Strelow. So you're here for Audrey. Was it Audrey Kropp?
Correct, yes.
And that's the best last name for anything that's an agricultural related interview, to have a last name Crop, I do have to say. And is Devin coming? So Devin won't be making it either, or?
Devin is, I believe, on vacation.
That's no excuse, Devin. I'm going to give him a whole. I hope he's having fun, though. Do you know where he is?
I do not. No.
All right. We won't hunt him down. I'm like, Devin, you can still get Zoom on your cell phone. He's probably on a beach in Cancun right now, really enjoying the non-Columbia County, Greene County weather.
That would be nice.
Well, so Audrey Strelow, thank you so much for joining us on the Monday afternoon show. You want to just give us a little introduction and who you are?
Sure. So I work with Audrey over at the Cornell Cooperative Extension, and I am the program coordinator for the Natural Resource and Environmental team, working primarily in the climate change and environment sector.
Okay. And so do you directly overlap with Devin as well in his work over there?
I do. We all kind of, I feel like we do. He's kind of got a hand in everybody's projects.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are kind of a team over there. You have lots of divisions and specialties and whatnot, but at the end of the day, it seems like Cornell Cooperative Extension is like a sort of a well-oiled machine, just a good team of various people and various expertises. Is that kind of how it is?
That's how it feels to me. I think you hit the nail on the head.
Okay. Well, I mean, you've been around for a while, right? Cornell Cooperative Extension. I mean, how long now?
That is a great question. I personally started last October, but I know the organization has been around for many, many years in every county of the state. So,
I think it's like the late 1800s or something, right? Isn't it like pushing over 100 years?
Could be.
Or some version of it has definitely come out of Cornell for a very long time now. Mm-hmm. We got so much farming going on. What's going on in your world over there? So you're specialized especially in climate change activities and how that relates to, you know, agriculture, natural resources, and agroforestry, forestry, all that stuff that you guys deal with over there. You want to talk a little bit more about what you do?
Sure. Right now we're working with the County of Columbia County, working with, I think, 17 municipalities, doing a climate adaptation and resilience plan with them. So that's been a bulk of what I've been doing lately with Audrey and our team. And then actually come spring, I'll be going back out to the Hanacroy Creek and doing the eel monitoring out there, which is always really fun. And we all always need volunteers.
I remember years ago, I was living over there, and you were looking for volunteers to like help count eels and whatnot. I forget So how do you get the eels?
So we have a net that we put in the creek, and it kind of looks like a funnel. Has a big mouth at one side, and it kind of becomes smaller on the other end. They find their way inside, get trapped for overnight until we take them out and count, and then we release them.
It's primarily a count that you're doing, or do you do other... You're not doing biopsies or anything like that, right?
No, just the counts. We will take the temperature of the water, the temperature of the air, any other observations that we have of the surrounding area, and kind of generally see like how the eels, if they're stressed, will adjust the net to make sure that's more in the water, and then make sure they're released further down so they don't get trapped in the net again.
How does one contact you to become a volunteer for the Great Yearly Eel Count?
You can call our office. Should I give the number right now?
Sure.
It's 518-622-9820. And then, you know, say that you're interested in the eel count for next spring, and they'll connect you with myself, and I'll put you on the volunteer list with an email, and you'll get any announcements that'll be coming up for the spring. And then once it comes a little closer to the spring, we'll have the event posted on our event site on our website.
Gotcha. Now that's, for me, one of the more sensational ones, but like you said, you're doing a lot of other stuff over there with climate resiliency and then communities being equipped for a changing just world and ecosystems. And what are some of the other projects or things that you're working on over there?
So we have some stuff going on with our, let's see, flipping through the notes here. We have a women's game of logging, which is going to basically go through the skills on with women only on how to learn the skills of chainsaw safety and operation. And we have two different levels that are happening in October. On October 13th, there's the women's game of logging level 1. And then on October 14th, there's the women's game of logging level 2. Which is great. I've actually done the level 1, so I can attest to that. It is a fantastic program.
And, yeah, how'd that go for you? How was it like learning chainsaw safety and all?
It's thrilling and a little scary, but once you get into it, you get really comfortable with the machine and everything else kind of falls in place. A really great instructor, really great women that come out, and it's like kind of learn by doing, and it solidifies a little bit better in your head that way too.
Yeah, it can be pretty terrifying having done a lot of chainsaw work over the years, a lot, and never actually having taken any kind of formal chainsaw safety or formal course. Or, you know, I still pick up a chainsaw to this day, decades later, and I'm like, I have an absolute 100% healthy respect for, it's not just the chainsaw, it's actually, it's the nature of the tree and the wood, right? And it's the hidden forces inside, the way something binds up, like if you're felling, or if you're doing branches, like the tension of a branch. Like stuff has happened to me to this day, which I don't even know how it happened because of hidden forces and tensions inside the wood itself. So it's not just the tool, the saw and the person and the user. It's really what you're working with, trees, which are to be respected. Yeah. That's one thing I'd take away from it.
Yeah, absolutely. The respect of the tree and respect of the chainsaw, both.
Yeah, and it's great to see, you know, diversity, to see this opening up to women, being able to sort of, I mean, it must be pretty empowering to know how to, like, take down a tree and fell it up and turn it into firewood for yourself, you know. I mean, it's not a lot of people can do that.
Yeah, it's kind of empowering, too, when you fell the tree in the exact spot that you were going for, too.
Yeah, Yeah. So tell me once again, when is that workshop? That's the October 14th, did you say?
Yeah. So the level one is October 13th. It's a Friday from 8 to 5 p.m. And the level two is Saturday, October 14th from 8 to 5 p.m.
All right.
And both are located at the ACRA office.
Is that the agroforestry? What's going on with the agroforestry these days?
There's a lot going on. I was going to say my coworker Tracy can speak more directly to what's happening over there. But she's definitely involved in the women's game of logging. We also have a... Let's see if there's anything directly related to agroforestry on here. We do have a autumn woodland walk with a forester, which is again at our agroforestry center, October 21st on Saturday, 10 to 12 p.m. And that's going to be walking through Sayula Lumada Forest with our resident forester, Mary Spring. And she'll be able to... talk about forest health and the importance of forest management plans, and then explain the history of Sayula Model Forest, touching on some of the agroforestry that we probably have going on over there.
And they can, folks can always contact your office, go to Cornell Cooperative Extension, or do you have the website in front of you actually, the cce.edu.something.org, whatever. Do you have that?
I do. It's ccecolumbiagreen.org/events.
ccecolumbiagreen.org/events. So there you go. That'll give a whole schedule too of what else is going on. Do you have other events you wanted to mention?
Yeah, there's a lot. Don't know how much time you have.
Just go for it. Sure. Go pick your favorites or just keep going down the line until 6 o'clock hits and then we'll cover it all. Lindsay, let's go. What's the next one there in October?
So October 1st, feels like right around the corner, is the putting the garden to bed, how to prepare for winter, which is going to cover your veggie and your flower beds, getting them prepped for the winter, discussing soil, composting methods, how to properly clean and store your tools. So that's, Sunday, October 1st, and then there's another one Thursday, October 12th from 5 to 6 p.m. There's also a supporting individuals with autism, training for parents and caregivers, which is Monday, October 2nd, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., and that's going to be in our Hudson office. There's a 4-H art show opening, which is going to be at the Agroforestry Center here in ACRA, Saturday, October 7th from 2 to 4 p.m. Touched on the game of loggings that's coming up. And we also have an introduction to native and invasive plants, which is Sunday, October 15th from 10 to 12 p.m. over in the Hudson office. We have an anger management class for 2023, and that starts October 16th and is held every Monday for 12 consecutive weeks, and it's held in person from 6 to 7 p.m. Let's see. We have a trained logger certification, Navigating Wetlands in the Woods, and that's going to be at our Agroforestry Center here in ACRA, Friday, October 20th from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. And I believe the last thing that I have not mentioned yet is a Taste of Twin Counties, which is our fundraiser for CCE of Columbia and Greene Counties. And that is going to be Wednesday, November 8th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. And that is going to be over at the barn at Liberty Farms, over in Ghent, which is in Columbia County.
Oh, yeah, Liberty Farms. They've come a long way.
Yeah.
Taste of, like, you guys probably even have the best food there for that fundraiser, aren't you?
Yeah, there's Can't remember the chef, but that we have a really good chef over there. Everybody that's had his food has raved about it, so very excited to taste it. And I've actually never been to Liberty Farms, so it's going to be a twofer for me.
Nice. It's right there on 66. I used to. Wasn't it Liberty Studs, and then I think Polly Vaughn was running that whole show, or running a whole portion of that operation, or getting it changed over from Liberty Studs to a more farm, diversified farm operation, or vegetable and whatnot. So I want to know more about Liberty Farm, especially since I think that's the same one that Polly Vaughn was doing.
Yeah, well, she
I hear good
come.
Things, right?
Sorry, yeah, no, I've only heard good things. I actually don't know the history. That would be interesting to find out if that was the switchover. A good way to find out, I guess, is to come to the fundraiser and talk the Liberty Farm
people. Or do a little bit of research, for crying out loud. I should know this. You know, been around for a while now. There's Gallagher Stud, Liberty Stud. Yeah, Route 66 right there. Fundraiser coming up. That's in November now. And probably some good folks. Definitely sounds like some good food happening. And you can meet Lindsay and a whole bunch of other people over there. Lindsay, you want to tell me a little bit more about the climate stuff? Like, what other activities? I'm always really... If you had another minute to talk about climate resiliency and communities and agriculture and whatnot, what are some of the things you're focusing on or working with in that regard with the climate change team that you're on?
Yeah. So again, it's going to be the plan that we're working on with Columbia County and the 17 municipalities within it that are signed up to get their own plan as well. And that's, It's been a big haul, and it's been amazing working with all the municipalities. And we just had a public survey that was out. It's now closed, but we will have a second public survey coming up after these workshops that we have with some of the stakeholders, which actually is tomorrow. After those two workshops, we'll be working on the second survey for the public, and I believe later, after the second set of workshops is over and the second survey is closed, we'll have a public kind of like a open comment period.
Okay. Is there one area in the climate resiliency work that you're doing that you're most fired up about or most excited, or one area that you feel most drawn to, whether it's like agriculture or planting trees or solar panels or whatever it may be? Do you have something you're connected to?
I really kind of gravitate towards the, I'm going to go with like the, shoreline maintenance. So there's like riparian buffers that is actually, if anybody's familiar with the Climate Smart Community, it's an action within that. And just with the maintenance and connection with the municipalities and the waterways that are around them, bridging the gap between the two. So working with the municipalities in that fashion has really been a great experience, and seeing how everybody has come together to complete these projects within the Climate Smart Community. So I guess talking in a little bit of a circle here, I think, yeah, the Climate Smart Communities as a whole, now that I'm getting to it, there's so many actions, obviously, to do with climate change that it's really inspiring to see the municipalities reaching out and getting aid from either us or doing it on their own and completing all these projects. So, yeah, I think that's probably the most inspiring and passionate part.
Cool. It sounds like, part of that sounds like just getting ready for the floods.
Mm-hmm.
The biblical proportionate floods. Are you from around here?
I'm from a little bit of everywhere. I don't know how far back you want to go.
Okay. Were you around for like Irene and Sandy?
I was in New York City for Sandy.
Okay. So I always get it confused. Irene was the one that hit upstate the worst, and Sandy was the one that hit New York City the worst. Is that right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, and they were both predicted like wrong. Like, it was so crazy that, like Irene, then nothing happened. But then upstate, like in the Catskill Mountains, you're talking about riparian, you know, like waterways, like the buffer zones. And, like, I mean, it was devastating up here for Irene. I mean, just, like, roads washed out because of all this water coming down in these valleys and mountainous regions and these creeks just wiping out infrastructure left and right. It was pretty wild.
Yeah, I've heard lots of stories, seen lots of pictures from people in the municipalities that have talked about it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so you're getting ready for the next Irene. I mean, it seems like every season now we get some pretty wild storms out there. We've been getting some crazy weather. It's just nonstop, it seems like to me.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I'm interested to see what this winter brings, too.
Oh, yes. Winter is coming. Speaking of chainsaw work, I got to get my wood all lined up. I got the wood stove. It's like, I'm ready to get it fired up. I haven't fired up the wood stove yet, but it's time to give in.
Yeah, it's getting there. I think it's going to be
some
in the
chilly mornings. Are mm-hmm. you up in the mountains there a little bit?
I'm not. I'm actually over in the Hudson area. So.
Yeah, so I'm over in Great Barrington area. Similar climate, but we still had some chilly mornings, so. Getting ready for that. You heard Lindsay Straylaw. Folks, look up Cornell Cooperative Extension. Women's chainsaw safety, chainsaw work, women only, 10-13 and 10-14, level 1 and level 2 courses. We got the forestry walk on 10-21. And we got a host of other, if you weren't listening, activities and events hosted by you guys over there at Cornell Cooperative Extension. I always appreciate hearing what you're up to. Tell Devin have a great vacation if you talk to him before I do.
I will.
Hope it was great. Leave us to do all the work here while he's out with he's probably got a drink with an umbrella in it, maybe. I don't know.
I hope so.
Maybe. Well, Lindsay, really nice to have you on the Monday Afternoon Show. Thank you so much for sharing all that with us. Well,
thanks for having me.
And keep up the good work that you do over there.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Gasto Saraguate Paulette Moore is a longtime documentary and independent filmmaker, podcaster, and educator. She will be giving an interactive talk at the Sanctuary called Indigenous Lens on Media Making on October 3rd. She joins me now. Welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Oh, I'm so happy to be back. And I love Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So it's great to be here. Thank you.
Could you please reintroduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. So wat guanawaradu se wagwego gasto seraguate yungyats. That means greetings, love, and respect from me to all of you. My name is Gasto Saraguate Paulette Moore, and I am a Mohawk citizen, Ganyunge Haga in my language, at Six Nations of the Grand River. I'm a Mohawk speaker and a filmmaker, podcaster, and educator. And I run a media organization called the Aunties Dandelion. And what we do is focus on revitalizing our communities through stories of land, language, and relationships. So really from an Indigenous lens is the way that we're making films and we're making our podcast, which is going into its third year now. And we just really are looking at ways to feed our community through these stories and shore people up. And it appeals to Indigenous and non-Indigenous people alike.
You first began your career in the mainstream media. What drew you to media?
In the first place, yeah, that's a great question. I really